That was just as an example of how people can use you for, you know, it's like, oh, like this guy, he wants to do an interview with you. You better jump on it, you know? And then all of a sudden, like, oh, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, who's this? All right, we need all of Thursday. Okay, well, who's this guy? You got an interview with this guy. Who is he? Oh, Mike DiRico, Rock Under Fire, you know? He gets like 800 downloads a month. Oh, fuck him. We don't get, you know, we're going to go on the Today Show, you know? Mm-hmm. Stuff like that.
Well, I thought KK Downing did it right because he made the rounds with everybody. He, when his book came out, and that interview was like an hour long, and I listened to the whole thing. I mean, just the questions were compelling and really put him at ease and drew a lot out of him that other interviewers didn't.
That was one that was pissed me off because Blabbermouth took excerpts from that interview and started a shitstorm for KK Downing, which lasted for like 6 weeks. And so they would pull a quote from my interview, put it in their magazine. You'd have all these fucking hateful comments from Judas Priest fans like, oh, KK, you know, what does he know? And no, oh, KK should be grateful. And KK should be kissing Glenn Tipton. Like all these horrible responses aimed at KK Downing because of my interview. And my name wasn't even mentioned once, man. My fucking podcast wasn't mentioned once. It was just like, you know, and it's just like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I know the types you run that like Blabbermouth and Metal Sucks. It's all clickbait. They just take the most salacious thing they can find. They try to exploit it, and then they, you know, good or bad, they don't give credit to the original interview. They don't say read or listen to the original interview here. They just exploit the most worst parts of it.
It's just like the way writing is today, where they're, you know, I like content could be somebody picking their fucking nose, you know, and like they'll take like an interview and they'll take one sentence, make a headline out of it, and that's their content. And so they're going to get people to click on that, and they're going to write about it, and they're going to read about it. And then 2 days later, they're going to take the same interview, get another sentence, and there's going to be a headline out of that. And like, they milked my interview for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know,
or you'll have these sites that they'll blow something out of proportion. Like they'll be like, I'll go online, I'll be like, tragic details about Jack Nicholson. Like, oh no, Jack died and he's fine. And they just take something else and they twist it around. It's like, oh, you made me click on that. Like,
10 things you never knew about John Lennon.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, number one, he was with the Beatles. Number two, he died. Number three, he moved to New York City.
Yeah, he did? Oh.
I hate those things. Where it's like, 10 things you never knew about so-and-so. You know, like they were like the obvious things. Like, 10 things you never knew about Kiss. Like, they made a disco song in 1979.
Yeah, that's for the completely uninitiated people who maybe it'll help people who really don't know and they need a real primer on certain artists.
So I'm talking to my cousin Paul Sizalak, who we used to actually play in a band together. You were either my drummer or I was your guitarist.
I don't know.
One of those things. If we take the Charlie Watts approach.
Yeah, I regrettably don't have any recordings from that era, but those were good songs.
I have recordings of them, but they're on cassettes.
Yeah, and I got rid of my cassette player. If you had it on CD or ripped it to a file, I remember the Jacket Dance. I remember Nico on Ecstasy. I remember there was one. What was the name of it?
The man with the glasses and a stick and a thing on his arm.
Yeah, but there was another one that was more like it was more anthemic. We played that one bar that no one was paying attention until we played that song, and everyone turned their heads, and it was like, I forget the name of it.
One of my songs, or it was
like no, it was an original song, and I remember like the beat. It was played on the bass, the floor tom. It was like a.
I'm trying to think like that.
Mid-tempo song like that.
You were in the band when it was a three-piece, right?
Yeah.
So you've been at this writing thing a lot longer than I have, too. That's another thing.
Yeah, I mean, mainly working for other people, but you know, you just try to bring value to everything you do. And yeah, just try to weather all the changes that go on with writing, especially like with the web, with SEO and all the other things you have to learn and know about in order to produce content and everything.
Yeah. Just don't be rating any of my interviews, man, and isolating like one line at a time. And, you know,
And you know
that about KK Downing.
Yeah. You know, those sites have like teams of editors and writers who do that on purpose. That it's almost like a TMZ. Like they deliberately pick apart things that can be exploited.
That's
and
what
throw it out there.
Me of. It's like TMZ, but it's like TMZ even is like, has some use in a way that they break stories. And
yeah,
it's almost like it almost has this like layer of validity to it. Like TMZ, we used to be like, oh, TMZ is like, I don't know. There was a time where like on a level of a historian, you don't trust Wikipedia. You know, Wikipedia is a no-no if you're doing research. It's like everybody knows Wikipedia is a no-no. And there was just like, it's TMZ. Oh, it's TMZ. Oh, you know, it's just TMZ. Come on. Now you hear TMZ, it's kind of like, oh, it must be true.
Yeah, I remember they broke Michael Jackson. They were the first to report he died. None of the other major news outlets wanted to confirm it. They were right. They got it.
Yeah.
When he passed suddenly, that was they had the news first.
And it used to be like on the level of like, I used to think of him as like tabloid-esque. Yeah. I mean, I still do. So you're out in Minneapolis now.
Yeah, I know.
Have
Believe
you
it or
become
not.
acquainted now with the music scene there and what's cool and where the places to go to and the places to avoid?
Haven't seen the local music scene firsthand, but I mean, where I work now, I like I say, I have the good fortune to work in downtown Minneapolis, right down on First Avenue, down the street from the First Avenue Club, which is still a thriving venue. It's basically like, it's like the CBGBs of Minnesota, basically. I mean, that's where Prince filmed Purple Rain. Across the street, there's a huge mural of him that they painted.
Nice.
Along the block I work on, there are smaller clubs and other venues that just walking around, driving around, you'll see people lined up around the block that even if you don't recognize the artists' names or the genres, it is a thriving music scene. Definitely. There is a definite rock scene akin to like a period in New York way back when, where it's heartening to see that. Plus the like the local record scene. There's a cool record shop I go to in Minneapolis called the Electric Fetus, which was like the counterculture, the Minneapolis version of the vintage vinyl, basically. And I was just there a couple of weeks ago, packed. I mean, vinyl, I can't believe the comeback that it's made. I mean, people just shopping for records. CDs are like stuck in the back like a neglected child or something, but like vinyl, it's so heartening to see like, wow, like the thriving music fandom that's around here. I guess I could say maybe it would rival Detroit. It's as far as being on the same part of the country, maybe like Chicago. It definitely counts as a major city with a thriving scene for
sure.
Oh,
it definitely does. And you hear that by all accounts of Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people that are there. Not just you. I mean, over the years of people I've gotten to know over the internet, you know, namely Tommy Summers, who's out there.
Oh,
he's like a big yeah. real estate guy out there. And he
That's
does,
right. I forgot about that. He lives around here, yeah.
He does the Three Sides of the Coin podcast.
Yeah.
So I've gotten to meet him a few times and had a few just very brief exchanges online. I mean, he's got what he's used to in terms of podcasting is far more than I can ever imagine, because those guys got huge in terms of Kiss World. Like it's Kiss and it's them in terms of being like advancing the conversation on Kiss for Kiss fans, by Kiss fans, having the approval of the band, having the band take part in it. I mean, every member of KISS, except for every living member of KISS, except for Paul Stanley and Peter Criss, have done Three Sides of the Coin.
Even Gene has done it? Oh, wow.
Even Gene, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
But Paul did recently call on the telephone Mark Cicchini, who is a member of, who's part of Three Sides of the Coin. He's on the cast. So Paul knows about the show.
Was that about the Ace Frehley thing with the, where he threatened it was those
about,
guys?
It was about when the engineer who worked on a couple of KISS albums swore that Bob Kulick played on Alive.
Oh, that one. Yeah, that's right.
And Paul heard about it, and Paul personally called Mark and told him, no, this did not happen, you know? And so, I mean, again, these guys, I owe part of this podcast to them, because Mike Brandvold, who is basically the ringleader there, it's his podcast. He's the main guy there. And I had an argument with him in like 2014, early 2015. And those guys don't like people going off topic in their Facebook comments. Stick to the topic. Don't, you know, and so I got involved in some other discussion that kind of took off into left field somewhere. And he was just like, oh, keep it on contact, keep it directly to the, whatever the subject is. And I said something regarding ticket sales and whatever it was. I forgot what we were arguing about, but he was just like, you know, if you want to change the subject, get your own podcast. When you have your own podcast, you could say whatever you want, blah, 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 you know? And so I was already thinking about doing this podcast, but that was just like, you know what? That's it. I'm now, that was like the deciding factor, you know? Mm-hmm. And a couple of years later, actually not a couple of years later, that same year, because Rock Under Fire was kind of new, I met him for the first time. And I came up to him, introduced myself. I say, I have a podcast. We're about 10 episodes in. And I said, I have a podcast because of you. And I told him about, yeah, you and me got into it. We had an argument and you told me to get my own podcast. So I got my own podcast. But it's funny because he hooked me up with some guests, you know? So it's kind of cool the way things kind of turned out, you know, like he hooked me up with Robert Duncan. He hooked me up with Joey Molland from Badfinger, who's also out in Minneapolis with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So that record store, I wanted to ask you, like, are you still buying vinyl? Are you still looking for
it? Yeah, more than ever before. I mean, it's a pretty equal mix at this place of used and new. But I mean, the stuff that they're releasing new, I mean, what did I buy last week? You know, basically, like we've always talked about, catching up on things that you never had before. Like, yeah. I'm gonna go see Peter Gabriel in October, and I thought, I've never had any of his Genesis albums. I never owned them. I never had Lamb Lies Down on Broadway or Selling England by the Pound. So I went and I got them. I just browsed around. I was like, oh wow, brand new Genesis, sealed the way you would have gotten them.
Are they sealed, brand new prints, like printed now in these days, or are they from like the 70s?
No, it's not old stock. It's brand new. Like some of them are 180 gram vinyl, but no, it's all brand new. It's so amazing, like how it's all made a comeback. Like everything's back in print now.
Yeah.
If you're looking for like older albums, it's like we've gone back to 1980 again, where like going to Sam Goody in the mall and like that's the only format that was around. Record stores are just like that again.
It's funny. Like I went in a Barnes and Noble of all places, you know, primarily known as a bookstore, and like half the store is vinyl records.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I went and I just browsed Beatles. I mean, you know, we've got all those albums already, but it reminded me going with my dad to Sam Goody back in the 80s and leafing through the vinyl and finding the same stuff. And it's like, it's all back now.
The worst condition vinyl I have are Beatles records. I really need to replace my Beatles records.
if you want to get them new, they're all in print. They're all there. You can find every one of them. It's not like it was in the 90s where vinyl was sent to the graveyard. It's back in a big way. I never thought that analog music would come back like that.
Yeah, it's like the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles do remasters like every 2 years. Like the entire catalog comes out again every 2 years or something. I know it's a little bit of exaggeration, but when the last ones came out, I missed the bus, man. On like, I really, really am kicking myself in the ass for not getting a hold of a copy of the mono Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah.
You know, because it's out of print now. Now it's no longer available.
Yeah. Small, such a small window. I got Let It Be. That was Giles Martin. I don't have the Revolver that he did yet, but I got Let It Be. Danny Harrison did All Things Must Pass, the whole box set that he did of that. Very tastefully done remix, not too radical.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool seeing like the next of kin of the Beatles alumni doing some of these releases.
Giles Martin, does he radically alter the mix, or is it something that's like, wow, I never heard this, or where did that come from, or something sticks out that you never noticed?
I didn't notice that on Let It Be. On All Things Must Pass, it was Danny Harrison and I forget the name of the guy who did the mixing. Some things stand out that I never heard before. Because, you know, Spectre originally had just washed that in reverb, drenched it in reverb, and George really never liked that. So they brought George's voice to the forefront more, like he sounds more close-miked when he's singing. But some of the instrumentation is brought to the forefront.
You're talking about All Things Must Pass. Before.
Yeah, yeah. So I think some of these are really well done. You know, then you got things like, that what was it, the Double Fantasy Stripped Down that I think Yoko did, or I don't know who headed that up, where they just kind of stripped down some of the glossy production on that one was a little bit more like the Let It Be Naked, where
see,
they
I wasn't
actually
even aware they did that.
Yeah like if you go online you could, you know, Watching the Wheels, where it's all the same stuff. Nothing new has been added, but things have been taken away, where it's like John, the piano, the drums, you know, none of that, you know, that was a very lush sounding album, very entering the 80s, but
yeah.
Double Fantasy, the stripped down version is a good take on it, a good take on that album.
I could still get, like before Vintage Vinyl closed, one of the last things I wanted to get, and I was looking at it for like months and months and months, maybe over a year I was looking at this thing on the wall, and it was a vinyl Sergeant Pepper mono copy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not easy to come across. You know, you could order it on Discogs for probably like $150.
Someone must have uploaded it to YouTube. To at least hear the differences, given that it's an entirely new mix.
I always have problems listening to it on YouTube because, you know, my computer, I got my computer speakers, or it comes out of my phone, which is one speaker. And
or sometimes the uploader will inadvertently only download one channel out of the two.
Yeah, I mean, really all you need is one speaker with mono, but, you know, but I really hate these stereo mixes that come out of like one speaker sometimes, so you'll have like one half the song taken out, like just disappear.
That's what I mean. Yeah, like they'll take out half of it. Like I was listening, it was Doc and Breaking the Chains. That actually first came out as Don Doc in like 2 years prior with a different mix, and it was on YouTube. I was like, okay, and I was like, this sounds weird. It sounds like only half the song, and someone said, yeah, it's like the left channel only. You're not hearing the whole thing. Hotter Than Hell, that happened too. There's a version on YouTube where it's only half the album, like half the mix.
I had a cassette copy of Sad Wings of Destiny in the, you know, like in the 80s, and it was the worst. To this day, it remains the worst stereo mix I've ever heard, because the entire cassette, you could, like, if you listen with one speaker, they're like Halford's vocals are taken out of every song. Like you could do karaoke to the entire album if you
want. Was that just the fault of the mix of the cassette? read it?
Or... Well, that's what I'm wondering. If the cassettes, I would think that it's the same mix, that the cassettes and the vinyl got the same, sounded the same. No,
I
mean, it's the way it's mastered or the way it's mixed or whatever it is. It comes off the same master. No.
Yeah.
The cassette.
Those first two Priest albums are almost akin to what I would think of a movie being in the public domain, where they don't own the rights to those two records. They weren't on CBS yet. So there's so many versions that have come. I think what I have is like a 2-in-1 CD. It's Rock and Roll and Sad Wings on one CD that I bought years ago. And they sound fine. It's a CD. It's like one disc, but both albums. It's like 21 tracks or something. And it's not like an official release. It's not a bootleg, but it was like just independently released.
I would think that that's Gull making whatever money it could, or whoever, whatever Gull is now.
Yep.
Does it even exist, or some subsidiary of Gull, or somebody that absorbed Gull, or some? I mean, somebody's got to be making money off those two records. So they're probably licensing that stuff to anybody they can. Is going to put out all these different versions of it.
Which is why when they did that, that retrospective, that 50 heavy metal years or whatever it was called, I don't know if songs from the first two albums are on there, because it's not, you know, everything after Sin After Sin is theirs. But
well, I talked to KK about that. I specifically asked him about that. And well, but before I get to that, I have memory, correct me if I'm wrong, there was in the 80s when Priest got really big in the States, Rock-A-Rollo got re-released with a different cover. It had like that warrior guy, like with a sword and a, like, you know.
It was actually.
But I could have sworn it was on an RCA label. It wasn't the Gull label. I could have sworn. I might be wrong, but I could swear it was the RCA label.
I think you actually gave me your copy. The copy that I have is the one that you gave me once.
Yeah.
And I know the cover that was a cover of a sci-fi novel. It might have been Michael Moorcock.
Right.
They took it from there to emulate like the Hellion and all the imagery that they were doing at the time to make it seem like it was a new album when it was already like a decade old.
When next time you have that album in your hands, pull it out and like see. I mean, I'll be very surprised if it's actually RCA. And that would be my next question. Why would RCA be licensing the Judas Priest first record in the 1980s? I guess maybe because they could.
Yeah, here's
RCA. Yeah, man. See?
Yeah, RCA. See?
Speaking of vinyl, man, you happen to be at the right place at the right time, man. When I, in the mid 90s, decided I don't want my vinyl anymore. What am I going to do with all this vinyl? Speaking of vinyl. So I've told the story on this podcast so many times when the subject of vinyl has come up. And it's funny because I say, well, I gave away a lot of my vinyl in the 90s when I didn't think I'd give it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have the guy I gave a lot of that vinyl to right here on this podcast. Yep. I didn't even think of that. So this guy made out with a lot of good stuff when I didn't think I'd ever play vinyl again. But I got most of that stuff back. I actually bought all that stuff. So like my music collection, I've now bought three times. Once on vinyl the first time, the second time on CD in the early 90s, repurchased my entire collection on CD. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of rebought about maybe six. I've got back maybe 65-70% of my vinyl the second time. But and I could have gotten 100% of it, but most of the vinyl I've bought in the last 3 years has been jazz records. And like, I'm going to hold this up to the camera. Our listeners can't see this, but stuff like this.
Yeah.
You know, and this is where I'm at right now, man. This is, John Coltrane, Donald Byrd. This is really good. This is like Steely Dan before Steely Dan.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with Steely Dan. I mean, this guy played on a Steely Dan record, I think, but I was really taking advantage of the jazz section of vintage vinyl before they closed. you know? And it was just kind of like you said, cleaning up, like going after all the stuff that you never got into or you were always curious about. And I don't know, maybe it's partly being an adult and your tastes changing and stuff, and you kind of just get a little bit more refined and choosy.
Yeah. What you want to. No, I agree. I've been doing the same thing. Like, at work writing, I've got music playing all day on my earbuds, and it's that type of thing. I've been getting more into listening to jazz too, and discovering things or gaining an appreciation for things I never appreciated before that I overlooked, or I was dismissive of, that I'm appreciating more now.
Is there anything, now that we're on this subject, and I've had this discussion with a couple of guests on this show, every time we come to this discussion where we're going off, getting into stuff that we always were curious about, or stuff that we never gave a chance to, or just like, again, the cleanup phase, right? Mm-hmm. What's left? What haven't we gone after? Is there anything that you've gotten into in the last year or two, three, that you either couldn't stand back then, like 20 years ago, you're like, I don't like this, or like, you know, something that's taken you by surprise, like, wow, this is really good. What was I thinking 20 years ago, 30 years ago? You know, is there anything mm-hmm. like that that kind of stands out? That's taking you by surprise?
I guess being a hardcore metalhead back in my teen years, I was dismissive of a lot of other, like I always felt being an ardent Headbangers Ball freak back in the day, I would always dismiss 120 minutes. I've been getting a lot back, gaining a new appreciation for the alternative stuff that came out, like listening to old REM, which I guess I was a little dismissive of at the time. I like that jangly 10,000 Maniacs type of more cerebral, intellectual college 80s, no artifice type of stuff. Like that it's always been around, but I feel that I've appreciated it more now that I actively seek it out, listen to it, where it was just kind of there before.
It was like the other side of the 80s when metal was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause we were in high school and like, that's what the college kids were listening to. So
yeah.
You know, short haircuts.
Yeah. Getting more like into prog bands that I knew about, but I never really took time to discover, like a lot of krautrock and prog bands. There was a band, a French Australian band called Gong. They're all dead now. Like the two principal singer songwriters are now deceased, but I was like, I've never discovered them before. Like I heard about them, but they were so such an important part of the genre. Listening to jazz more. I mean, you mentioned Coltrane just the other day. I was listening to some of his more free form stuff. It's so cacophonous sounding, but it's so great. And I think I would have never really given that a chance back in the day because it wasn't 4/4 rock.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Somebody off the wall Coltrane, like I can only listen to for like 2 minutes before it causes an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think even artists that were just always mainstream that I just never gave a chance to, like, I listened to a lot of like Frank Zappa, Captain Beefheart, Tom Waits now, that they were always around, and Tom Waits is the only one left, but I never gave him a chance. I was like, yeah, they're around, but I was too much into other things, and now I'm discovering them. It always seems to be after people pass away, I finally get around to rediscovering their discography.
That's happened with me a few times. Like it took me to like Scott Walker.
You know? Yeah.
Like when he died, that's when I first started listening to his albums. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. He always intrigued me. I knew about him just because he took such a departure from that like Baroque pop to this like dark, demented stuff that he did, where he was built. he was rubbing elbows with like the whole goth scene, you know, those types of dark artists. For him to transition into that genre is pretty something. And you know, just getting more into, for me, just more into like classical music, Indian music, kirtans, you know, non-Western music, just kind of thinking like maybe the way we kind of set ourselves up for a future musical path when rock music finally dies, we're gonna need to listen to something. But I suppose it's a long answer. That's really what I've been doing, rather than listening to the same stuff over and over again. Just
it is, getting into some. A lot of times I have this conversation with people that are just like, oh, you know, like I can't get into this. And how do you get into that? And like people are listening to the same Metallica record like 40 years later. And it's like, yeah, you know, like, oh, Metallica, you know, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, you know, and like the same shit. I mean, no, look, I mean, the early days of this podcast, we were talking about Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and the Beatles and the same bands. To the point where people were very critical of that, but it taking nothing away from those bands. Those bands will always be what they are in terms of the importance of the big picture. But I don't have to listen to another new band for the rest of my life, and I'll have enough music to last me the next 10 lifetimes in terms of going back into the past, in terms of different genres of music. And even staying in rock, if you want to stay in rock, there's still stuff that I've never touched on that I could go another 10 years, you know. And
same here, like if you put aside the fact the year that it came out, if music is just eternal, it doesn't matter if you're discovering something from 1975 brand new, it still means something.
It took me 52 years to finally listen to Yes. Right, that's my answer, and you know that because I talked to you like I probably talked your ear off about Yes like the entire summer of 2022. Every text I sent you was about Yes.
Yep.
And because I know you're a Yes fan, and I know like and I know Yes fans my whole life. I've known people that like Yes, and I always found it weird, like they're so boring and they're so this, and they're like, oh, I can't listen to Yes. Oh, I tried, and I did try. Damn, I tried in my early 20s so many times. People, because it was this one guy who would just put Yes in our face all the time and made me listen to Close to the Edge, and it was horrible. Like, and like it, and to this day, like I'm still not crazy about Close to the Edge. Like Yes is a little too off the wall at times for me. But that said, I love Fragile. I've seen Fragile my whole life. I know. I see the album cover. I've heard the radio songs my whole life. Roundabout was always there, but I never realized how fucking great it really is, because I never got past the beginning of the, you know, that little acoustic part that Steve Howe does.
Yeah,
I always thought it was pretentious and annoying. I was just like, you know, like I would always turn it off. Long distance runaround. And I'm talking about the FM radio songs. I would always like turn it off. I would always hear it. I was always hear it in the background. I would never really pay any attention to it. And I love it now. Like I like on Spotify, I'm guilty. I stream a lot of my music is streamed, you know, and because I'm at home, it's in the background. I play it in the car. My most listened to band of 2022 was Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roundabout, Long Distance Runaround, two songs that I've like my whole life have followed me on the radio, on FM radio. Every time I turn on WNEW, one of those songs are on, you know, along with the usual Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and the usual suspects. But I really heard that stuff for the first time in many ways, you know, and, you know, South Side of the Sky, where it was called. Awesome stuff. And then I try to listen to like the stuff from like whatever that one is, the one after it, Topographic something, Tales of the
that's the one that led Rick Wakeman to leave. That one was a little bloated, and
some
they got,
of it is a little too over the top.
Yeah,
I like melody. I need melody and structure. When it starts going, you know, like fucking crazy Jackson Pollock shit, man. Like, you know, I can look at Jackson Pollock on a canvas and discover the brilliance of it. But when I have to hear it in music, the equivalent, the musical equivalent of Jackson Pollock, it just causes an anxiety attack for the same reasons that, like, I can't listen to Ohm by John Coltrane.
I was just listening to that the other day. That's what
space
I meant.
Is the place, like Sun Ra, Space is the place or something like that. You know?
That's what I mean. That cacophonous, like,
yeah,
just noisy saxophone stuff. It's yeah.
Give me, you know, like I'll take Crescent, Blue Train, that's the John Coltrane I like, the album he did with Johnny Hartman, and Coltrane ballads, like that stuff, man. That's as monumental as any Beatles album.
I would say probably, talk about discovering things. I guess when we start to lose faith in rock music and think it's going to die out, there are some genres that are kind of surviving. Like I was always a huge Black Sabbath fan. And I'm sure you've heard of it, the stoner metal, doom metal genre that was more of a contemporary thing, really past 20 years, just the slow, sludgy. There was a band I always liked called Sleep. They came out of California, and they split up for a while, and then the bassist and the drummer formed their own band called, speaking of the Coltrane, called Ohm, O-M. And it was a duo, not even a trio. It was a duo initially, where the bass basically doubled as a guitar. It was so overdriven, but it was just droning, almost like if you combine metal, sludgy metal with a mantra. And those are the songs, like 15 minutes long. Just it's hypnotic but heavy. And there's a whole genre of that. I never knew any of this existed. Relying a lot on that old 70s with the orange amps that they use, and all that. And that's a genre that's going strong. There's a whole legion of bands out there that are still new. They're not big. They still play small places. They release their stuff independently, but it's that type of stuff that I never really knew about. And then I discovered it, and I thought, it gives me hope that certain genres will keep going.
You know what I think you would love, man, if you don't already have it or haven't heard it, man? It's Alice Coltrane. Alice Coltrane is called Journey to Sachinanda, I think. And it's an album she did with Pharoah Sanders, who just recently passed away about a month or two ago.
He was in Coltrane's band, right? John Coltrane.
He's done like a lot of things.
Alice Coltrane, I've always been interested. Yeah, that's right. She converted to Hinduism. Yeah, that's right. She was big into the transcendental side of things.
I'm looking it up.
I was listening to Ohm just the other day, and
You're right. He was.
He played the tenor sax. Yeah. I didn't know that he died only recently. That's too bad. 81. Yeah.
But
certain other things, just to keep answering that question, certain other things also catch my ear for some reason that I never would have thought. I guess, like, you know, YouTube is a big help, because when you listen to something, you'll get other suggestions. One guy I've been getting big into is Bill Evans, the pianist.
Yeah.
Who had a very drug addled life. But I mean, I was listening to a lot of his stuff all the way up to the end of like the early 80s. And it's just great stuff. Great stuff that, as a drummer who was only into the 4/4 rock, I would have never appreciated that stuff 20 or 30 years ago. Never. I would have never, ever even considered it. But now I'm digging all that stuff and seeking it out and buying it.
I think like even 30 years ago, not quite 30 years ago, 30 years ago was what, 1993. So I think around like 90, I remember it was 99, because I was going to the Springsteen, I was driving to the Meadowlands for the reunion, the E Street Band reunion tour.
Yeah.
Happened like the same, the next night Eyes Wide Shut opened. Like there was like the greatest weekend of my life of the 90s, because a new Stanley Kubrick movie opened and Bruce Springsteen E Street Band reunion tour, you know?
Yeah.
Back to back nights, man. And so I remember driving to the Meadowlands, listening to Kind of Blue, Miles Davis. And this was at the time, like I was 29 years old, and at the time, it was like, you know, the basic, like Rock 101, Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, you know, and like that type of stuff, like Rock 101. And like, it was like Jazz 101. And so like the two go-to jazz artists for rock fans are always Miles Davis and John Coltrane. It's like the two jazz artists that all rock fans know, you know, and
yeah, they're like the crossover guys who help you get into the other genre. Yeah,
exactly. So I was like doing that. But like in the last 5 years, it's been like, okay, the musicians that backed those guys, you know what I mean? So it's like, now it's like, okay, now I love listening to McCoy Tyner, you know, and like, he's like Coltrane. He played piano on those great Coltrane records in the 60s. And it was, again, I hold this record up again, cause it's my favorite. Like I like this, like when they say Love Supreme, that's like the quintessential go-to Coltrane record. I think this is better than Love Supreme. I'll take Crescent over Love Supreme. That made me realize that McCoy Tyner is the true secret weapon of the quartet, right?
Yeah.
That period of John Coltrane. And I include Love Supreme. McCoy Tyner's 70s albums are really good. Donald Byrd's 70s albums are really good. Bill Evans, I don't have anything by Bill Evans, but like I keep my jazz records under my desk. So as you can see, I'm like reaching down under here, but I keep them separate. But I'm trying to think, like, the guys of the background, the guys in the background of like Art Blakey,
I was just going to say him. Yeah.
Produced a lot of great names came from Art Blakey, because basically everybody played with him at some point, you know?
I only really heard in earnest his name recently because, speaking of Yes, Bill Bruford, who's retired now, he started his own YouTube channel in the past year strictly as an archival thing to say, I'm retired and now I'm going to put everything on my YouTube channel that I've done. And he's done some interviews where he always keeps name dropping Art Blakey as one of his big influences. He wasn't a rock drummer, Bill Bruford, and he was all into jazz drummers. And so I learned about Art Blakey from Bill Bruford, not really knowing who his influences ever were.
Yeah, yeah. It's very common, especially like in terms of my trajectory, my personal trajectory in terms of the music I've gotten into and how I've gotten into and when, artists turn you on to other artists. You discover artists, like, and that goes with art, film.
Yep.
I mean, like, it was through Woody Allen that I got into Ingmar Bergman and Fellini, you know, like directors like Fellini and Bergman and Godard and Truffaut, all that stuff. Even like in my early 20s, when I was reading shit, like you got into, like, you know, everybody has their like French, I don't want to say French existentialism, man, but like your existentialist period, like Kierkegaard and Dostoevsky and like stuff like that, like all that shit, man, which I call shit now, got through Woody Allen. You know, you watch two movies, you watch Manhattan and you watch Annie Hall. And I know it's very politically incorrect to even like Woody Allen these days, but you know, once you take all that stuff, you peel that stuff away and you just stay to the art, you watch Annie Hall in Manhattan and you come away with like 30 names. And you're just like, who is this? Who's that? Like, what's this? Like, who's that? So it's like, I remember watching both those movies when I was like 20. And I'm like, who's this? Who's this? Who's this? Who's this? You know? And and Dexter Gordon, like, I'm holding this up. This is what the part where of the podcast where you almost wish it was like, this is the part of the podcast where you almost wish it was on video where you could see it. Because like another thing, I'm holding up this record to the camera. And this is Dexter Gordon, Sophisticated Giant. This particular one is not too well known, but there's a period where he goes to Paris and he makes a bunch of records in Paris and he comes back to New York. And this record plays like an orchestra, it's very full. It's very like there's a lot of good stuff on this record. Sophisticated Giant. There's a movie I watched from the 80s that he plays some character, like a jazz guy. I forgot the name of it, but it's something like 1986.
I'm looking it up here.
A
He was in
movie
a
that
he was in Awakenings. He had a cameo in Awakening.
Dexter Gordon?
Yeah,
I
yeah.
never saw Awakenings. Is that with Robin Williams or
And Robert De
Robin De
Niro,
Niro?
yeah,
Yeah, I never saw
Robin
that.
Williams. Oh,
There's
yeah,
a movie that
excellent.
Dexter Gordon did in like 1986. I forgot the name of it. He plays like a, you know, he plays a sax guy. Are you looking it up?
Round Midnight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess so. Round Midnight. I watched that about I guess about a year ago.
One of the things that, really makes the rounds now in the dialogue of rock music is the whole lip syncing thing. Have you touched on that before on at all?
On the lip sync. Oh, you mean like bands singing the tracks on the current farewell tours and stuff?
Yep.
And like the way where when rock stars age, they tend to lower the keys so they can sing their songs. And then once it gets past that point where that no longer works, they have to start singing the tracks. Yeah. Very little, not nearly as much as Eddie Trunk. Eddie
Yeah.
Trunk is like obsessed with it. I mean, I don't have one opinion of it one way or the other. You know, it's if you're that age and you're up there and people are paying to see you and people have no problem with it, they want to see you. I don't, you know, it is what it is. Everybody knows that you're 80. Everybody knows you're 75, 80 years old. You know, I mean, it is what it is. You know,
Yeah.
it's not like you're deceiving people. Everybody knows. I mean, I don't even know why they deny it at this point. Any group, like certain people deny it, you know. But what do you think?
I guess it's slightly disingenuous. It can give itself away easily. I know Paul Stanley does it the smart way. At least the recordings he uses are new. They're slightly rough sounding, where it's more realistic. I'm going to see Wasp in August, and I saw footage of them recently, and apparently Blackie Lawless does that. They played that song, The Flame. Remember The Flame,
By
the first album? Wasp.
a wasp.
Until the flame burns out, it's got that really
Yeah,
high.
it's been years since I've heard like the first Wasp album is just Wasp, right?
And they played The Flame. I forget what city they were playing in, but I think
Yeah.
he was using the original studio track. It's just like
Really?
from 38 years ago. He
Oh
was it was up there, and it was in the
no.
original key. And it's like,
At least go re-record it in a studio.
and that's at least that's what it sounded like. And then I'm checking out footage 2 weeks ago of Peter Gabriel again in Italy, and he's playing Sledgehammer, Salisbury Hill. In the original key, he's not lip syncing, and the comments on YouTube, people were amazed. They were like, "That's the original key."
So I mean,
Sledgehammer doesn't sound lowered. The original key, and because he was never a screamer, he never belted
yeah.
out the vocals. He
I
doesn't
mean,
tour very
vocals
often,
aren't
but
that demanding, and you know,
no.
you
But
the same shape.
it's still remarkable though that it's the original key and it sounds exactly the same. How
Yeah.
some artists can still do it.
I mean, Bruce Springsteen, if I found out that Bruce Springsteen was lip syncing, then I'd be upset about that.
Yeah.
You know, because but he's not. So
Have to be honest, if I knew that a band like Kiss, like if we could look into the future and they were still around 10 years from now, still managing to do it with the same lineup and everything, I would rather support that, knowing that they needed help rather than them giving up now. Just to have them around, like having family members
it's
around. Just it's just
painful
it's
to, I just
Yeah.
wish, I don't mind if Kiss sticks around. It's just painful to watch them in that makeup.
Yeah.
You know, like they're like Paul's face looks like a battered pancake, man, with like, it's like, take the makeup off. Just go out there in your regular clothes. Like they bitch about, oh, it's hard, it's heavy to carry 80 pounds of equipment on your back. Well, then don't. Just
Yeah.
fucking play the music. If it's about the music, then prove it. That's the one thing they haven't done. Is just like,
It's yeah.
well, they, I mean, yeah, they did that with, you know what I always wanted to see, and it's kind of too late with Peter Criss being as like you know, incapable as he is at his age. I always wished we got a chance to see. And we were fucking robbed of this. We were robbed of this. I always wished we got a chance to see, among all of the incarnations of Kiss, in and out of makeup. We never got a chance to see a proper tour of the original band without makeup. You know, just the four guys that started it, just them playing their music, just them, their real faces, whatever they want to wear on stage, but just them, you know?
I still think that that original, although Ace and Peter weren't 80s metal guys, I still think they could have survived into the 80s and done a proper unmasking. Lick It Up wouldn't have happened, but whatever that album would have been, it would have been the four original guys just standing there in their street clothes. They would have had an MTV thing. They would have done a tour. They would have adapted like the Stones did or any other 60s, 70s band that had to adapt to the 80s. Like, they could have done it.
Here's why I don't think it would have worked. Because in terms of sticking with the trends of the 80s, neither Peter or Ace had the technical ability to modernize. Ace can't wail. Ace can't, as much as I love Ace Frehley, Ace as a guitarist is like the most basic limited knowledge guitarist there is. Nothing he plays goes outside of the basic pentatonic blues scale. 1-4-1-3-1-3-1-3-1-4-1-4. Everything Ace Frehley plays is in that framework. Peter Criss, a somewhat unorthodox drummer, is not. He's unorthodox. Peter Criss is all over the place. Mm-hmm. Yet he could not hold a basic, like, put Peter Criss behind a double bass drum and you would probably, I mean, you're a better drummer than Peter Criss. Like I'm a better drummer. I'm a better guitarist than Ace Frehley.
Yeah.
And you're a better drummer than Peter Criss. We can mm-hmm. safely, accurately say that.
Yeah.
They created better music than we did,
mm-hmm.
but we are more skilled players than they are. And I say that without ego. I say that seriously.
No, it's true. Like if I sat down on the kit and I had to join Kiss, I would approach it more like Eric Carr did.
Right.
That double bass, fast drumming type of stuff.
It's for the same reason that Thin Lizzy couldn't assimilate into mm-hmm. 80s metal. Although they did get that, what's that album they did with
John Sykes
that they made in 1983 where
Thunder and Lightning,
they attempted metal.
Yeah.
You know, they were too rooted in blues the same way that Ace Frehley was too rooted in blues, you know. They were too rooted in the Chuck Berry chords as opposed to the power chords. Which is why they needed Bruce Kulick and Mark St. John and Vinnie Vincent and those guys. It would have been nice if Ace Frehley and Peter Criss stayed in the band. It would have been nice. It would have been great if they would have like tried to, I don't know. I don't know if they would have made it. They would have, their music would have sounded too basic for where hard rock and metal went.
Yeah.
Unless they just tried to keep being. That's interesting because if Vinnie Vincent doesn't enter the picture, you know, all that stuff that we got off of Creatures and Lick It Up doesn't exist.
No.
Right? So it's an interesting question, but again, I'm the biggest Ace Frehley fan, but I'm also a realist in the sense that I don't think Ace Frehley would have evolved enough to be the guitarist that Paul Stanley wanted at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I think of how Ace in the late 80s had the most success he ever had as a solo artist with Frehley's Comet. Like, he was on a major label, he was on MTV, he had a real band, and he was able to make it for a little while with his style of playing. He didn't need to shred.
Yeah.
If he had been able to bring that to Kiss at that time, to think like what he was doing in 87, 88 when they were doing Crazy Nights, like what that would have sounded like in that era.
There were very few guitarists, and right now I can't even name any that didn't shred or didn't wail. You know, I mean, there were mm-hmm. some. I mean, like Def Leppard. You know, Phil Collin played some really tasteful guitar solos on Pyromania.
Yeah. You know?
But if you were a basic guitarist doing that stuff, they called you a poser in the 80s. You're just like, he's not fast enough. Or I can play faster. Everything was fast. Everything was mm-hmm. speed. Everything was, I could play faster than him. You know, yeah. it's like what Paul Stanley recounting Mark St. John's conversation with him about like play like Eric Clapton. Oh, I could play faster than him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. It's very true. I guess with Kiss, maybe, you know, and fans have talked about this, that the reunion tour was great, and then the old problems started to come in, and then Ace and Peter were soon gone, and then they get replacement guys. Maybe what they should have done was gone right back to the revenge lineup, bring Bruce Kulick back, take the makeup off, but then they would have gone back to playing clubs.
And that's what I wish they would have done. And yeah,
Paul and Gene, with that taste of millionaire success again, they can't let that go to this day. They would never lower themselves to that, even though it had more musical integrity and they made albums and they made new songs and created, and they weren't trying to recreate the 70s again. They were new, they were current. I was just watching footage of them from 94, 93, 94, and they were so tight. They were such a tight band. And those same four guys, I mean, the drummer, he's still in the band, and they could still deliver it that to a degree to this day if they had just gone back to that. It would be so great if they went back to that. I wouldn't mind seeing them in a small club.
I mean, at some point, like, you know, they would have been playing clubs, yeah, because once you bring Ace Frehley back and Peter Criss and a reunion tour, and like basically every Kiss fan has seen what they wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody that went to reunion tour, like a first generation fan, is going to put up with the revenge band after the original Kiss gets back together. You know, I mean, no, mm-hmm. I'm probably wrong on that. There's probably a minority of fans that would still, and like you say, consequently, they'd be playing clubs at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what? We had Ace Frehley and Peter Criss back for 6 years, and now we're going back to 1984, you know, and mm-hmm. it's like, or 1992, or, you know, it was kind of like taking off the makeup, save them, putting the makeup back on, save them,
mm-hmm.
And keeping the makeup is what saved them for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, they had to keep the makeup. They had to, because they know that it's future generations, the other generations after us and our kids and our grandchildren and their kids. And then it gets to the point with, you know, multiple generations going to see a band. You think a little kid today is going to be interested in Kiss if they didn't have makeup and costumes?
Yeah.
They're going to see the legend. They're going to see what Kiss was, which is why they need to hold on to those images, why they had to rewrite the narrative of, oh, this is the Spaceman and the Catman. This was never about Ace Frehley and Peter Criss, you know?
Yeah.
Who's going to be next? Turtle Boy? Like, I don't buy that stuff. I don't buy that, because they weren't saying that in 1982. They weren't saying that about Vinny and Eric. You know, they would, that was not the what they were selling. And that's where Eddie is absolutely 100% right. You know, because we were there to know that they were not pushing that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how many characters are we going to get? It was never about that.
Yep.
They didn't start pushing that until they needed to justify having the other two guys in the makeup.
Yeah, on the FAQ forum, they've had this. There was one discussion recently about like has the last 19 years of the band diluted, you know, your fanhood, and what would you change? And a few people said that okay, put Tommy Thayer and in the band, and bring Eric Singer back, but give them their own makeup design, because they're not characters. They were never supposed to be. Give them some, you make them the new breed of Eric Carr and Vinnie Vincent. Give the band a new look. No one's going to mind. It's just the spectacle of the show that people want to go see. And that would, and if they did that and they kept recording albums every 2-3 years like they used to do, that would have made them still an actively creative entity.
Like, you mean like post 2002?
Yeah. I think it would have worked in some way.
Yeah, it would have worked for a while, I think, in terms of new music. They just don't. I don't buy the whole thing of like. I could see their point when Paul says, "Why bother putting out an album?" You know, yeah, but that's because it's not going to sell. It's not going to sell. Number one, and number two, it takes a long time for a Kiss song to become a classic, so nobody's going to want to hear it, because they're going to want to hear "Shout It Out Loud" in Detroit Rock City and Love Gun for the 12 billionth time.
You know? And I think out of a lot of the old legacy hard rock metal bands, I was impressed with Firepower by Priest.
Yeah,
that was impressive. I saw them a couple of times live on that tour, and you know, of course, they're never going to measure up to the old songs, but they weren't bathroom break songs. That there was they played almost every song on that album on different legs of the tour, and they stand up well. You hear Victim of Changes and Grinder, and then you hear, the title track, or you hear, one of the other songs, Spectre or Never the Heroes, or one of the songs on Firepower. And you're like, yeah, these are good songs. There is still value in recording new music, and it holds up well. And so I think Paul Stanley is not giving himself enough credit that they could make an album that the songs could stand up well.
They devalue their entire existence, man. First they piss all over their legacy by making themselves expendable and saying they're not very important after all. Anybody can do this. It's all connect the dots, color by numbers. Anybody can fill this role. Okay. And then they did this bullshit about, well, what song are we going to leave out of the set list? Detroit Rock City. What do we cut? Rock and Roll All Night. Yeah. Yeah. One show. I want to see one fucking Kiss concert where I don't have to sit through Detroit Rock City. You can let it go. Why are they so attached to the same fucking 20 songs? Yeah. You know, I've never seen a band so attached to the same 20 songs as Kiss. And it's like, you know, I mean, Iron Maiden goes out there every 3 years with a new album. Judas Priest, they're out there playing new music. Metallica just put out a new album. Don't tell me why bother writing songs. Right? Nobody wants to hear new music. We want to hear the same. No, I've been with you since 1976, Paul Stanley, not you. I want to hear, I would like to hear. But you know what it is? It's probably like nobody wants to write for them. They dried up. They dried up creatively. You know, they're lazy, you know, as hard as they work on stage in terms of carrying their 80 pounds of equipment, man, they're lazy. They don't want to work. They want to do is the least amount of work put into their band, you know, the same stage, same makeup, same, you know, everything, same set list. And then they charge $5,000 per ticket if you want to hear them play like, She's So European, but you got to go on a cruise for it, you know.
Yeah,
the middle the cruise, of the fucking Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, the cruise gigs are the closest thing to what they should be doing all the time. Like I liked when a couple of years ago they play Creatures of the Night in its entirety. They had the costumes. They had.
They
the
said they were going to, but they didn't even do that much. They're fucking like Kiss is false advertising across the board. False advertising in every fucking thing they do. They blow it up, hype, and then they never fucking do. They always leave you underwhelmed, man.
Yeah, I thought they were good all the way up until Carnival of Souls, and then when they were got back together, then the hype started again. Then Psycho Circus was like, it's going to be Destroyer 2. Like, well, I don't know. Let's wait and see. And then it wasn't, and it's like, yeah. Oh, well, and then everything else is hyped up and it doesn't live up to the hype when I just liked them when they were just doing albums just like every other band, even if they weren't at the,
I remember like you remember I went to this concert with you, man. Like, remember the reunion tour? And you were like, oh, it's gonna be the Love Gun, and we're gonna do the Love Gun show again, and it's gonna be like you're gonna get to see 1977 all over again, and you're gonna
be stairs,
and then we got this like half-assed stage, like, what the fuck is this? You know, just like the most boring. Like, it was great seeing them, and they were playing these songs, and it was Ace Frehley in his Love Gun costume. But that stage show was like the most boring stage set they ever had. You know, like, it was like nothing happened.
The Kiss logo was too small.
It wasn't the Love Gun stage like they said it was going to be, you know?
Yeah.
Well, they never actually said it was going to be the Love Gun stage, but like it was understood that it was going to be, you know? It was kind of like a silent thing that they were going to put that show on again, you know? And then all of a sudden it was this thing, you know?
I think I've seen them
feel the wall of amps raised from the floor to the top. You know, they flipped over, you know. Well, they didn't flip over, but they were like, remember when the amps were lying on the ground and then they kind of moved up, formed the wall. Everybody was like, whoa, this is going to be great. And that was like the highlight of the show. Like when the amps moved.
I've seen them about three times since then. All with the Tommy Thayer, Eric Singer lineup. And I can't recall anything outstanding about the stage. I think the last time I saw them right before the pandemic was there was that big spider motif above the stage. That was the only interesting thing. And it had like no new album to tie it into. That was the only like interesting change. And then during God of Thunder, the last verse, when Gene comes back down to the stage, there are all these screens with him, his face singing the song, obviously pre-recorded, but like, that's interesting. But nothing about the stage design that you can identify, like the old tours, like, oh, that's from that tour, that's from that tour.
Yeah, it's like, all like, just from just, like 2004 until about 2012, like they had the same stage, the wall of amps.
Yeah,
you know, and like that spider was the monster tour, right? That was like Monster when they had the spider.
Was it? I thought it was more recent that they had that. Monster's already about 10 years ago. Maybe.
Like Monster, and then when they went out with Motley Crue was the spider.
Yeah.
Like 2012, 2013, 2014. That was the spider period.
It all blends together for me when there's no new album attached to it.
Yeah.
I can't identify, like, if I look at a footage of Kiss from the last 10 years, I don't see what year it is. I can't tell when it's from just looking at it. Yeah. Versus if I look at something from the 80s or the 90s or the 70s, like, I can say that's from that tour or that tour.
Yeah. That, like, it's all a blur. Anything after the first farewell tour is kind of a blur.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
This is like, we could go on talking about Kiss for, like, we could form a Kiss podcast of our own. For anybody out there that doesn't know, for the past 20 years, we've spent the past 20 years, you and me, talking about four things. Four things, four things only, man. Kiss, Judas Priest, Beatles, and The Shining.
The Shining, yeah.
That's all we ever fucking talk about, man.
Yeah.
Like my mother, she'll be like, yeah, you talk to Paul, how does he do it? I was like, I don't know. All we talk about is Kiss and The Shining.
Yeah.
You know? But, so yeah. So, I mean, it's, unless we're going to talk about The Shining, we're pushing about 2 hours here.
Yeah. And there's so much to say about that and all the different theories that have come out that are still new to me.
I gotta have
all the time.
There's no Shining podcast, is there? That's what we should make, a Shining podcast.
Yeah,
but you gotta host it, man. I'm done hosting podcasts and doing all and editing and doing all that stuff. If somebody wants to add me to their podcast, I'll be a commentator and I'll be glad to sign on. And I'll be, you know, but I'm just glad this is almost over. Like, I've got two more episodes to do after this.
Maybe it'll take on a new life somehow.
Maybe. I just got books to finish, man. I got something coming out at the end of the year, and I got something I got to get back into for after that. So this finishing this thing has been quite the daunting task. I used to have co-hosts, but things happen.
Yeah, good co-hosts are hard to find. It's people have obligations and everything. It's like trying to keep a band together, really, you know?
Yeah.
To get people to come to get together every so often.
There's got to be, like, I don't think there are any Judas Priest. There's no Shining podcasts. There's a lot of Beatles podcasts, probably. I wonder if there's a Judas Priest. Out of the four things we talk about, there's got to be like a podcast in there somewhere.
There are a million videos about The Shining, all the Shining theories, but not a podcast.
Did you get to see Dr. Sleep yet?
No, I never did. I saw parts of it.
Have you seen the Overlook parts?
Parts of it, yeah. I thought that was done well. At first, I thought maybe they just somehow took the original footage and managed to CGI it. But apparently, they rebuilt all that.
They rebuilt the over. I know they rebuilt the Colorado Lounge and the staircase and all that stuff. Like, they rebuilt it, shot it, and then destroyed it.
Yeah.
You know, it was literally up for like 2 days.
But I like all the new theories that are coming out all the time about that movie. I mean, the Wendy theory being the newest one. I was like, I never thought about that.
Oh, and yeah. You sent that to me, right?
Yeah, they it was very thorough. They gave so many visual examples of supporting that theory. And I thought, yeah, that's something to think about. I never thought about it that way.
There's a new book on John Lennon, the death of John Lennon, coming out. It might be out already. And the author, who obviously has a bigger reach than I do, because I'm invisible in the big picture in terms of writers, I'm invisible. I'm not even on the map. I'm not even in the phone book. But whoever wrote this book, he has a much bigger reach, and he's gotten some press over this book. And so he mentions, he's the second person after me that has brought the story back to the fact that John was shot in the chest and not in the back. The bullet, the entry wounds were in the chest. But where this guy goes off course is he gets into the conspiracy stuff, the multiple shooters, and, you know, so he gets into the multiple shooter thing. There's no evidence of that. I dismiss it in my book. So, but this guy will get the attention that I didn't get, in terms of, like, you know, he interviewed the same people I interviewed. So he has access to the same information that I got. But, you know, this is not new. The thing is that this information was out there on the night of December 8th. That he was shot in the chest, and all of a sudden they never said it again. He was shot in the back, right? That became the story. He was shot in the back. Chapman was behind him. The only thing new that I present that nobody ever has is that John Lennon turned around and was facing Chapman. He was looking at Chapman when Chapman shot him. Nobody ever presented that.
I took away two things from what you wrote, was that for years, everybody talks about how the limo let them off on the street and they walked up, but they never explained why. And you had said because there was a car that was double parked. So they were like, never mind waiting, let's just get out. And unfortunately, there was that. And then the thing with the chest, where if he did call out Mr. Lennon, or if he didn't and John remembered him from earlier in the day, maybe he didn't even say, like, what are you doing here? But more like, hey, what's going on? You're still here. Can I help you? Like, maybe wanting to help him, and then he blew him away. Meaning that he turned around to approach him in some way.
There's a couple of discrepancies in that, because getting back to the double park thing, it wasn't that, and I don't, this is what I've gathered. This is what I've pieced together. I can't say this is absolute fact. This is my takeaway from the evidence I've pieced together, that it wasn't that there was a car that was double parked. There was a car that was blocking the driveway, which I believe was a taxi cab, and the limo double
parked.
So the limo pulled up alongside of the cab and double parked. Yeah. And John and Yoko got out of the limo, went around the cab, and then into the driveway. That's what I think happened. And so the limo pulls away, the shots happen, the cab speeds away after the shot. So there are a lot of people that believe, well, who was that cab driver? You know? Who was, why was there a cab in front of the, you know? So all these people, the conspiracy people are like, okay, it's Reagan. Reagan did it. Reagan was coming into office. You know, the conspiracy machine that was put in place in the 60s that were, that got rid of all those liberal people, man, and killed all those, you know, is back in place. There's no evidence of it, man. You know, John, Mark David Chapman killed John Lennon, man. And he acted by himself. You know,
if the Republicans
was not involved in it, man, the CIA, they, the guy that they say Jose Perdomo was a CIA guy and he was in on it.
No, all four ex-Beatles at that point were out of touch rock stars, just trying to stay current. John had no more political activism. If anyone wanted to assassinate him, it would have been 10 years prior, when he had the megaphone and he was protesting and he was making a big deal about Vietnam. But in 1980, like, that's like the furthest time away. He wasn't doing anything except staying home. Like, he wasn't making any waves. I mean, why then? Why? Like, that's like, that's what was so shocking. If he was killed 10 years prior for his activism, it might have made sense.
You raise a point I never thought about. That if they would have got, if they wanted to get rid of him, they would have done it in 1972, like somewhere between 71 and 72, because they thought he was such a threat to the 1972 election that he was going to mobilize all these young people to vote Democrat, and that they would have like got rid of him in somewhere between 71 and 72. I mean, his most radical period. You know, when he's hanging out with, you know, like the John Sinclair thing and Abby Hoffman and whoever else. I don't know if it was Abby. Was it Abby Hoffman? No.
Yeah, I think so. Wasn't he?
I'm thinking of somebody else. But whoever was hanging out with him, some pretty radical people that like were on their radar. The feds and the police and Nixon. John was very much a threat because they thought he was much. He was never as big and popular as they thought. Like in terms of his influence, like Lennon could never have influenced galvanized the entire generation of kids to vote Democrat. I mean, you know what I mean? He didn't have that kind of reach. There was no social media. There was no, like, you know, whatever John Lennon was doing on one day, if there was a protest or a bed-in or something else, you would find out about it 6 weeks later in a magazine, you know? Even if a protest happened, you know, unless it was on the front page of the paper, you didn't know about it unless, Rolling Stone might report on it 6 weeks later.
Yeah.
You know?
I felt the same way when George was almost murdered. It was on New Year's Eve of 99 going into 2000. And I was like, now? Like, why try to kill someone? Like he's like 57 years old. Like, at the very least, you know, the comparable trajectory would have been like maybe when he was doing like charity concerts, like Concert for Bangladesh, maybe that might have irked someone when he was an activist. But it's like, now someone tries to kill him, and thankfully he survived. But it's like
thinking that, like, this is how the 20th century ends, with the death of another Beatle.
I remember that. I remember New Year's Day 2000. We were like, okay, Y2K didn't happen, and George Harrison was attacked.
Yep.
And I was like, damn. And but no, I don't believe those conspiracies about Lennon. How it was his activist days were. The unfortunate thing was that if the car did pull into the drive and he went in, Chapman would have come back the next day. He wouldn't have given up. He would have been there back the next day or the day after and tried again.
That was inevitable. Yoko feels the same way. You know, there was no stopping it. He was going to do what he was going to do. And the other thing is in terms of him, you said something that I forgot what I was responding to, but what I was going to say was that, you know, in terms of Chapman calling out, oh, when you said, oh, you're still here, Chapman was still standing around. How you doing? You know, he remembered him because he signed the autograph.
Possibly. Yeah, that could have been possibly could have been his reaction. Say, hey, are you OK?
The witnesses say he called out Mr. Lennon before he shot. Chapman denies this. Chapman says, no, I didn't say anything. I just shot. Now, Chapman also is not in his right mind. And Chapman is a fucking maniac. He's a mental case, right? He blacks out, or the film reel went snapped. You know what I mean? However he describes it. And he's pacing back and forth on the sidewalk, and he sits down and he stands up and he takes all his shirt and his jacket off and he throws it on the sidewalk. And like, he's doing all this stuff, and he's just basically just operating without a head, you know, like he's just moving around and reacting. At that point, he was no longer in his head. And so I think he did call out Mr. Lennon. He said something got John's attention to cause him to turn around, because he turned around. There's no other explanation that the bullets go into his chest, out his back. And then they said, well, how did the bullets get into the door if he's in the middle of the driveway in Chapman's? Like, duh. Like, why did nobody put this together?
Mm-hmm.
I believe John was standing in front of the door. He had already reached the door. He was in front of the glass door. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to get another shooter from the other side to hit John here and in a bit. Like, it went through John. It went through the glass. So,
yeah,
still, you know, I don't know.
Because the theory was that out of a six shooter, he missed one and one hit the glass door, but probably one just went through him because they were.
Well, there were five shots. There were five shots fired.
Okay, yeah.
And four hit him. And the one, I think there were a few that hit the glass. One that went through John hit the glass, and the one that missed went through, either hit the door or the glass or whatever it was. But it's not that hard to hit the glass if John is in front of it.
Yeah.
And so while everybody's trying to piece together this thing from an, and I think what started that was a very inaccurate drawing, the drawing that made the Daily News the next day. And there's a drawing in the New York Times, which
I've seen that,
John,
yeah,
in the middle of the driveway. And I don't think John was in the middle of the driveway. Chapman may have been in the middle of the driveway, like in between, like there's a wall and a driveway, right? And I'm doing this with my hands on the screen so listeners can't hear. But there's the wall, and the driveway in the middle, right? Mm. And the drawings and history places Chapman right here and John right here, but just 20 steps ahead. And he shoots. Right. I think John had gone down the center of the driveway and then turned and stepped onto the curb where there was the door. And he was about to open that door. And he turned around and Chapman shot. So I think he had reached the door. He was on the side of the driveway. The door, there's a curb. You step up. There's like a little step, and you step up, open the door, go into the foyer or whatever that was. And I think he had possibly stepped onto that curb, or he was about to, but I think he'd reached that door. So he was literally a split second from reaching out to open that door, and something got his attention, turned around, shoots, four of them go through him, the other one hits the glass. But I think he was in front of that door.
Yeah, that's really the pivotal moment to say what got his attention and what was John's reaction. I mean, he was known to react harshly. Like, he wouldn't have reacted with a temper. Maybe he was concerned. I always like to think he was maybe reacting out of concern because the guy was still hanging around, or I don't know, because they could have easily just retreated inside if they felt unsafe.
Well, that's what they did. I mean, Yoko it didn't even... Yoko saw him.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't say, I think he nodded or said, I don't know if he said something to her, but according to Chapman, Yoko just ignored him, just walked past. And she had already gone in. You open the door, you go up six stairs, you turn left, and there's Jay Hastings' office. the security, one of the security guys. And so John's about 20 steps behind her. So she had already gone in and up the stairs, and John's approaching that door, and that's when Chapman stepped off the curb and into the middle of the driveway and fired shots. Now, if that door, that's another question that I really didn't get into that much. And I would love to have access to the driveway, but you can't get through there. You know, they don't let you in. I mean, I begged the guard to let me stand here for 10 seconds. You could be next to me. You could grab my hand and walk me out. He would not go for it. I said, let me stand there for 10 fucking seconds.
you went there and asked?
Oh, many times. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I had only gone to the Dakota once. And it wasn't one time that we had gone to the city. It was another time.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Yeah. So many little theories that make you, like part of what you had discovered, what in interviewing all the existing surviving cops and nurses, and then the doctor, the one surgeon, how everyone tried to take credit. There was that, the whole idea about Chapman getting into a combat stance again, like, how do they know that? Did he say that? Because you said he was working without a head. He wasn't thinking straight. How do they know that?
Because it was a witness. I mean, there were people on the street. You know, Sean Strub was out down the street. Like he was in the park. He heard it. There was a woman on the street that saw it. Jose Perdomo, the guard, the main guard, saw it. So I mean, there were witnesses on the street that saw it. The thing that Sean Strub, he's a guy that became mayor. He's the mayor of some town in Pennsylvania now. He became like an AIDS activist years later. He said something initially that doesn't add up. He said that by the time he got to the Dakota, it was like just as the first cops were arriving, and when they pulled, he was standing right there when they pulled Lennon out. And they said that Lennon had his glasses on.
Yeah.
He said that night on the news, Sean Strub.
Mm-hmm.
But the other story is that Jay Hastings took his glasses off the floor because they came off his face, and he held on to them and he gave them to Yoko, which means that John didn't have his glasses on when he was carried out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's got nothing to do with how he was killed, but it's just a little detail that doesn't add up.
I'm wondering like how he would even spot a detail like that so far away, even across the street. How can you tell when there's such mayhem and you got like cops carrying this limp body? How can you notice something like that?
Well, that's the thing. Strub had walked up to the driveway. You know, there weren't a lot of people there just yet. So he was right there. He was right there when they came. Another one is that, you know, like they say, like, okay, four or five cops were around Lennon when they carried him out, which is true. But there were about 50 that swear that they carried John out. You know, it's kind of like, you know, there were only like 300,000 people at Woodstock, but like a million say they were there.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
There are actually cops that swear that they carried John Lennon out that weren't even at fucking anywhere in that driveway, you know? And there's one cop that's on video that he's like, yeah, when I saw him carrying out, I saw those Beetle boots on him and I knew it was him. Like Beetle boots, you know, like John was wearing fucking sneakers. There are all these, like,
he's still wearing the same Beetle boots in 1980 and
yeah,
none of them look the same.
John was wearing sneakers.
Yeah.
He was wearing sneakers, blue jeans, some sort of an Asian t-shirt that had like writing, like some sort of Chinese or Japanese writing on it.
Was it red?
A red t-shirt, yes. A black pullover sweater.
Yeah.
And a leather jacket.
I've seen
how he was dressed.
Yeah.
So of all the cops that say they were there, and at some point in the night, many cops were there. So there's no reason not to believe certain cops when they say that they were there. But when 20 cops claim to have carried John Lennon out of the office into the police car, we know for a fact that Tony Palma had his hands and Herb Frauenberger had his feet, or vice versa. But those are the two cops that had the main parts of Lennon, his hands and his feet. The two cops were Tony Palma and Herb Frauenberger. They were the second group of police to arrive. All right.
The first group were the guys who detained Chapman. They got him.
Correct.
Stayed with him. Yeah.
Correct. That is Peter Cullen. Okay. Cullen and Peter Cullen and Steve Spiro were the first two cops. Spiro detains Chapman. Cullen goes up the stairs, sees Lennon on the ground, comes back out, tells Spiro, you better cuff this guy. All right. Herb Frauenberger, Tony Palma arrive right after them, as though they're running into the driveway. By the time Lennon is out and Palma and Frauenberger have carried him out, many cop cars have arrived and they're all kind of facing the Dakota, blocking traffic going west on 72nd Street. Because their cars are not parked along the curb. They're parked against the curb, facing mm-hmm. the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time Frauenberger and Palma carry Lennon out, their car is blocked in by other cars. So they can't even get their car out, even if they wanted to. So as another cop car is pulling around and pulling up, that happens to be Bill Golden and John Moran. And that's the cop car that they, I'm sorry, Bill Gamble and John Moran. And that's the car that they put Lennon into. And that's the car that takes him to Roosevelt. Now, there is even a discrepancy in this because I don't want to say the name.
Did they even call an ambulance knowing that it would take too long? Was one even on the way?
They did call an ambulance, but they decided not to wait for it.
Yeah.
They did call an ambulance. Yeah.
Yeah.
So at some point, an ambulance shows up. Now, here's another discrepancy. I'm not going to give the name away, but like both nurses that I talked to, the main two nurses, and I've never heard this anywhere else, tell me that Steve Spiro brought Lennon to the hospital, which is impossible. They're like, but he was there. He was at the hospital. And I believe Steve Spiro. It's very possible that Steve Spiro went to Roosevelt that night. But Spiro was the arresting officer of Chapman. And Spiro went to the station with Chapman. So there's no way that Steve Spiro brought John Lennon to Roosevelt. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, maybe their memories are foggy or they...
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you try to, we try to recall memories from years ago and you remember talking to someone and you think it was somewhere else, but it was actually like sometime else during the night or on another night. And I'm sure that they know what they mean, but they're maybe just 40 plus year old memories are getting foggy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've gone over time here.